Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. Today I talk to lawyers. Criminal lawyer Michael Spratt, a partner at Abergel Goldstein & Partners LLP in Ottawa, and Anthea Milliken, the executive director of the Legal Clinic of Guelph and Wellington County. Now, politics and the law often go hand in hand, but the confrontation between the two has been making headlines lately because of cuts to legal aid, which are demanded by the provincial government. This vital public service allows people with no or limited means to access legal advice and representation, but budget cuts by the province are making it more tougher than ever. Legal aid is the topic of this edition of the Guelph Politicast. So last Friday, news hit that the family court support program sponsored by the Legal Clinic of Guelph and Wellington County and Guelph-Wellington Women in Crisis was the latest victim of provincial cuts. A weekly clinic for victims of domestic abuse, the service provided access to lawyers for advice about legal procedures, assistance with documentation, safety planning, referrals, and interpreters if needed. The clinic was offered Monday and Fridays for 3 hours each, and it was used well. And now it's just being offered on Fridays. This follows the announcement last month that our local legal clinic would be $10,000 short for the 2019-2020 fiscal year. And since the fiscal year starts in April, that means the legal clinic spent the first quarter of the year operating at a deficit without knowing it. Expecting that, perhaps. Expecting cuts, I mean. But not knowing the exact degree to which they would be cut back. In all, the Ontario government cut funding to legal aid by 30%. That's $133 million, and that took effect immediately. In response to the criticism, Premier Doug Ford called in to Alan Carter's Global News radio show and said, quote, "If anyone needs support on legal aid, feel free to call my office. I will guarantee you that you will have legal aid." But it's uncertain how many have taken the Premier up on the offer, and it certainly seems that Ford has not held up his end of the bargain. In response to the cuts, Michael Spratt wrote the following in the magazine Canadian Lawyer, quote, "The reality is that cuts to LAO or Legal Aid Ontario do little to solve Ontario's deficit issues. If anything, they may end up costing the system more. But they do guarantee cold and cruel unfairness, and it is only going to get worse." Now you may say, worse? Well, while previous governments have not had the gall to cut legal aid, they certainly haven't allowed funding to keep up with the pace of demand. As Pratt argued, while cutting legal aid is meant to save money, in the long run it might cost us more as people struggle for fair representation, which grinds the wheels of justice to a slower pace and results in potentially more innocent people ending up behind bars. So on this week's edition of the Guelph Politicast, we will hear from Spratt on the negative consequences of legal aid cuts from his point of view as a criminal attorney who argues cases for clients receiving legal aid. He'll talk about the complexities of being a legal aid attorney, what people may not understand about the legal system, and why it's full speed ahead on these cuts, even though the government is full of lawyers that should know better. And then we'll hear from Anthea Milliken about how the cuts are directly affecting the work being done out of Guelph's own legal clinic, the Legal Clinic of Guelph and Wellington County. So I caught up with Michael Spratt by phone from his Ottawa office last week, and I caught up with Anthea Milliken by phone from her office at the Legal Clinic earlier this week. So Michael Spratt, thank you for joining me today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
I just want to start out by asking, from my own personal observations and my limited legal knowledge, it seems to me that it was already pretty tough to get legal aid, to get, you know, that kind of assistance to navigate the legal system even before the government cuts went into place. Am I reading that right?
That's right. Over the last, I'd say, 30 years, we've seen a slow decline in access to justice, and specifically access to justice for people charged with criminal offenses and may have their liberty taken away by the state. We had a time in this province in the 1940s and the 1950s where there was no legal aid. There was no assistance to individuals who lived, you know, at the margins or below the poverty line. And governments recognized that that created a lot of problems, not only injustice problems of wrongful convictions, but problems of administrative issues with how justice is dispensed, because individuals who don't have any prior knowledge of the legal system can get lost in sort of that bureaucratic maze. And so from the 1950s through the 1980s, we had an increasingly robust legal aid system that was exported around the world, that was the envy of many developing countries and the model for much of what we've seen internationally. But since the end of the 80s, we've seen death by a thousand cuts, like literally a thousand cuts, budget cuts, service cuts. And up until very recently, we've got individuals who live below the poverty line who can't access legal aid, and individuals who may be facing jail time or in jail time who can't receive the assistance of legal aid, even though they can't afford a lawyer. And then we had Doug Ford, and things got even worse.
Right. It just, on top of that, there was, to talk about the cuts to legal aid, you know, going on 30 years, I think that's been a sort of a government-wide thing where we've sort of seen the budgets shrink either through the cuts or because of inflation, and the funding hasn't kept up with inflation. But it seems, you know, from my reading of what has been going on, the legal aid system in Ontario was preparing for cuts even before the cuts were announced back in April with the budget. And so that has resulted in things like legal aid not covering bail hearings.
Yeah, I mean, legal aid has been, I think, getting ready for this. Even under, you know, the previous government, Liberal government, who, you know, became known for spending on programs, we didn't really see the legal aid program get the attention it deserved. So we had already seen reduction in legal aid services, not covering certain files, more stringent tests with respect to loss of liberty, and, you know, not granting discretion for increasing payments for complex cases, and not not following through on some programs that had been quite successful, like have paying for a junior counsel to attend a trial with senior counsel so that work could be done more efficiently. But then after the Ford government was elected, I think we all saw it coming, and there was more belt tightening at legal aid. But then as a direct result of the funding cuts, we've seen, you know, whole swaths of immigration and refugee service be completely eliminated. And we've seen, you know, more belt tightening, if it can be, if belts can be, you know, tightened anymore, like punching new holes in this belt to tighten it even more. And now we see in the criminal side, I think the two biggest things that that stick out in those cuts are legal aid is no longer going to be paying lawyers. 2 hours is what we got paid.
Right.
We're looking at about $250 to conduct bail hearings for individuals. And legal aid is also slashing by almost 50% the amount of hours it will pay for lawyers who represent Indigenous offenders to conduct sentencing hearings that specifically take into account their Indigenous background and heritage and all of the trauma and tragedy that goes with that. So we're seeing even more cuts, and there's going to be more to come.
It's interesting because the CBC article that you wrote for CBC Opinion made the note that we're cutting funding, but we're going to end up paying for it. And so, you know, when you hear that this $250 an hour just, you know, to cover a bail hearing, what the end result of that is people aren't, may not be able to get bail because they won't have the proper legal representation, which means more people will be sitting in prison cells, which, you know, we all pay for because people in prison have to get three meals a day and have to have, you know, facilities for, you know, showering and toiletries and all that. And so, you know, the cuts on one end, you know, are going to have an increase on the other end just because there's going to be extra people in prison.
That's right. This is a real example of being, you know, penny wise and pound foolish, because at the end of the day, it's going to cost more, not just for individuals who shouldn't be in custody, but are in custody. When we have more unrepresented people in court, that takes up more time. It takes about twice as long to conduct a matter in terms of court time to move someone who is not represented through the system, because there can't be the sort of admissions and streamlining that can happen when you have counsel.
Right.
So we see trials take twice as long. We also see the amount of time that it takes from start to finish of those criminal cases where individuals are unrepresented. We see that that is increased when they don't have a lawyer. And so we do see an increased, you know, justice expenditure for the administration of justice.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are like the financial reasons. And then, of course, there's, you know, sort of the hidden costs where if someone is wrongfully convicted or wrongfully pleads guilty, then they then have a criminal record, which might impact future reintegration and job prospects and community involvement, which can have costs. And I think one of the biggest things here is that we're looking at perhaps a decrease in public safety. If we warehouse more individuals at jail, if we don't deal with individuals appropriately, if in an adversarial system they don't have an advocate on their side and it's a lopsided fight, we're going to see more individuals who face criminalization, and that ultimately doesn't bode well for public safety.
Right.
You know that when people are incarcerated either before trial or after trial, there's whether they were guilty or not, there's an increased likelihood that they will commit future offenses when they come out of jail. Jails don't do a very good job. And in fact, in the province here in Ontario, we don't have very many treatment programs at all
right.
in our provincial jails. So jails don't rehabilitate. They educate on how to break the law, and they provide motivations and disenfranchise people. And that can actually decrease public safety. So because of
right.
these cuts, we're looking at an increased cost, but we're also looking at decreased public safety, and we're also looking at reduced court time. So that means we could have charges of individuals who are charged with serious violent offenses, they could be thrown out of court, as we've seen in some cases, because we're using that court time on individuals who aren't represented.
And we already had a problem, and I'm not sure if it was countrywide, but I think it was Ontario, where we've had issues where the constitutionality, you are entitled to a speedy trial, and we, because of court time, because of a lack of judges and a lack of available attorneys, we've seen cases thrown out because time was up, and you know, you are entitled to a speedy trial, and that has not been happening as often as it should.
Yeah, and we saw that. I mean, it hasn't been as bad as it was in the 1990s when almost 50,000 cases were thrown out in Ontario after a Supreme Court decision.
Mm.
But it's been pretty bad. I mean, we're looking at an upper limit of 18 months to get a trial in the provincial court and 30 months in the superior court. For anyone charged with an offense or anyone who's been the victim of an offense, that's too long to start with. But we have seen some serious cases be thrown out of court because there aren't enough resources. And part of that reason is the unrepresented accused in court, and part of that reason is just because we put too many minor and nonviolent offenses through the criminal court. It's sort of a one-size-fits-all solution.
Right.
And there's only a certain flow-through you can have in our courts. It's not an expandable pipe. And, you know, right now it's bursting, and, you know, the cuts that we see at the provincial level to legal aid are, I think, only going to make that worse.
Is there a point where, I mean, I don't think the legal system can grind to a halt, but I mean, is there a point where the system just can't hold anymore, where, it's going to be incredibly hard, maybe for some of these minor cases, just to move forward because there's just no support for them?
Yeah, and what we see in court is actually a snowballing. Like, the worse it gets, the worse it becomes, which makes more delays. So it's sort of a self-feeding cycle. What happened about 10 years ago when there was underfunding to legal aid and large service cuts 10 years ago, there was actually a work action by lawyers who accepted legal aid.
Mm.
And that work action, you know, led to some chaos in courts. And, you know, that's a very difficult position to put lawyers in, because we have obligations to the administration of justice. We have obligations to our client.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're in a different position than, you know, some other sort of organized, union members or organized labor movements. But, I mean, that is the real risk. If this gets really bad and you have courts that are overflowing with unrepresented people, you may have lawyers just say, well, I'm not accepting legal aid. I'm not doing this case on legal aid, and it can get even worse than it is.
Right.
So, I mean, there is sort of that doomsday scenario on the horizon, and I mean, the really risky part is that once you cross that line, there's really no going back. Once this problem gets too big, the wheels of justice can grind to a halt. And, you know, if it affects, you know, public perception in our justice system or the legitimacy of our justice system, then we have real problems, because the justice system only really derives its legitimacy from, you know, the perception that it is legitimate. And once we start monkeying around with that, then, you know, we're into all these Trumpian problems we see in the States about, you know, democratic institutions being slowly eroded.
Yeah, and not just that, but, you know, speaking of Trump and things, you know, it's a judicial crisis in many ways in the border in the United States too, because there are so many people being taken into custody and the legal system can't keep up because there's not enough immigration judges, not enough court officials who are able to speak Spanish or different languages of people being taken into custody. And so it's a self-fulfilling prophecy there too.
Yeah, and I mean, what I think I really want to make clear, because there's been some, you know, some Trumpian language that we've seen from Ford about, mm-hmm. you know, lawyers making too much money and legal aid lawyers as sucking at the public teat and things like that. I think for most legal aid lawyers, for most lawyers who take legal aid, and most lawyers do, it's amazing in Ontario, if you are live in poverty, and I mean, you already have to live below the poverty line to qualify for legal aid.
Yeah.
So I mean, we're already looking at cutoffs for assistance that are well below what they should be. But if you live below poverty and you're facing the prospect of jail, and you are issued a legal aid certificate, you can access a level of justice that is unheard of. You can have some of the top lawyers, you know, in Toronto, in Ottawa, in your community, will assist you.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's amazing. I think it's why a lot of criminal lawyers like myself get into this line of work.
Mm-hmm.
If we wanted to make money, we would be on Bay Street.
We have the
court skills and the litigation skills. We can go toe-to-toe with any of those, you know, three-piece suit Bay Street lawyers, but that's not what we want to do. And to some extent, the government counts on that so that we sell our services at a discount.
Right.
But it's not really about money at all, because, you know, you can do one case funded by a private client, and that will pay more than, you know, all of your legal aid cases put together. We do, I think, probably we work 5 hours for every hour that we're paid, and we are paid for that hour at vastly reduced rates.
Mm-hmm.
We're not doing it for the money. We're doing it because it's the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing it because we're the people who sit in court who watch David versus Goliath. I mean, this is an adversarial system, and the Crown is armed with, you know, professional prosecutors, a team of investigators, the police, forensic labs, unlimited resources, and they're up against someone with no legal education. And that is such a tragic thing to witness firsthand, because in real life, David never beats Goliath.
Right.
In real life, that fight is over before it begins. And I think a lot of the reason why so many lawyers are upset, both from the immigration bar and the family bar and lawyers who look at, you know, residential tenancy issues and criminal lawyers, is that when there's this funding cuts like we see now, and when legal aid is being denied to people who live on the street, who are in jail, who are facing lengthy jail periods, we have to see the aftermath of that fight, and we have to see that fight go on if we don't step in, and it's disgusting.
I did note your David and Goliath metaphor in one of your other blog posts, and how our legal system is predicated on having equal sides, and it was already unequal to begin with. If you're dealing with, you know, someone on the legal aid side, because you're already kind of fighting with one hand tied behind your back. It's the idea that we had equality in the legal system is has always been sort of, I guess, aspirational rather than actual.
Yeah, it's more aspirational and less descriptive, that's for sure. And I mean, this is the thin edge of the wedge, right? It's easy to turn your back on individuals who may be marginalized by poverty or addiction or mental health, who have been criminalized, who have other issues. But we live in a common law society where there's, you know, judge-developed law where the state will take every inch of ground that it can.
Right.
That's sort of the adversarial nature of things. And if rights are eroded for one group of people, you know, they're eroded for everyone. You know, one of the questions that criminal lawyers get asked all the time is, you know, how can you defend that person? I mean, he's a drug dealer, and you're, you know, bringing a charter application, trying to get evidence excluded. How can you do that? You know,
right.
He's guilty. And the answer quite often is, well, I'm not just defending him, I'm defending you. Because if we let the police, because they think he's a bad person, you know, conduct illegal searches or detain him illegally or abuse his rights, then, you know, that diminishes the rights for everyone else. And so that's what we're looking at here as well. It's not just individuals who are impoverished and in jail who are going to face injustice. This can lead to larger problems for, you know, even the most law-abiding citizen.
Right. It's the difference between sort of like the practical law that is practiced every day and sort of the, I guess, maybe the Hollywood fairy tale version of the law where bad guys are accused and they go to jail. It almost seems like we should have a reverse system where the defense has more resources, more, you know, investigators, you know, and you know, the prosecution, because, you know, our system is innocent until proven guilty. The onus is on the prosecution.
That's right. It's the, you know, it's the old tired saying that it's, you know, better to let, you know, 10 guilty men go free than convict one innocent. And I think that we often, members of the public, tend to think that, you know, if you're charged, then, you know, probably something's guilty. You've got a criminal record, like, you know, the police don't get it all that wrong. But the sad reality is that our courts are full of individuals who are only there by circumstance, only there because of systemic bias. Innocent people go to jail all the time, and, I mean, the hidden fact is that innocent people plead guilty all the time, especially when they don't have a lawyer.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that is one of the largest injustices, and, you know, what can be said without a doubt is that because of Doug Ford, more innocent people are going to be going to jail. And if you think that truth, that innocence is a defense in our court, you've got another thing coming. Because
right.
You have a litany of wrongful convictions. I would have thought that we learned our lesson, but, you know, it is true. It is not hyperbolic to say that because of Doug Ford, more innocent people will have their liberty taken away.
Well, again, I'm no expert, but it does occur to me that there are a lot of lawyers in government, not just people who work in the civil service, but, you know, people who are elected to office. A great many of them tend to be people with legal degrees. And I'm wondering, where are those people in terms of advising, you know, the Minister of Finance, the Premier, about, you know, the damage that they might be doing cutting legal aid? Because they would surely know.
You would think so, but I mean, Doug Ford just fired his attorney general, Carolyn Mulroney, for doing exactly what he told her to do. So, you know, I don't know if she was pushing back in the back rooms or if she was just an empty sock puppet or if she was, you know, a willing complicit actor, right? I don't know, but our new attorney general, Doug Downey, is a lawyer, and he should know damn well that what he is overseeing, and I think it's incumbent on all lawyers, whether you're on Bay Street, whether you're in government, whether you're directly affected by these cuts, or, you know, whether you work for legal aid, I think it's incumbent on us to speak out. There's a reason that behind the saying, you know, kill all the lawyers. And it's not because lawyers are bad people. It's not because lawyers are devious. It's because when you want to have a totalitarian regime, you kill the people who are going to speak out first and have the power to make change, and that's why you kill all the lawyers, because it removes the power that can oppose you. That's where that saying comes from, and so I do hope that, you know, we have more lawyers speaking out before we have, you know, courtrooms that are bursting at the seam and before our courthouses turn into factories of injustice.
But it is interesting that we've come to view it the other way, and I think that Doug Ford hits upon something that, you know, lawyers are an elite class, and I think people think about that sort of macro vision of elites versus non-elites and not get into the minutiae. I wonder how many people who support these cuts have ever, you know, been in a courtroom or understand, you know, how the minutiae of how the legal system works, like from the point of view of somebody like you who does work in the criminal justice system.
And I've been inviting Doug Ford to come and see what it's really like. I mean, the most disgusting thing about these legal aid cuts is shortly after the cuts were announced, but before we heard about what the details of what actually would be cut, Doug Ford said to a radio station in Toronto that he guaranteed anyone who needed legal aid would get it. It was a personal guarantee he made, and so, you know, I've been writing to him over the last 69 days, almost every day that I can. I think I'm up to over 40 letters I've written to him and the Attorney General, trying to find out about this guarantee, find out, you know, how my clients who have been denied legal aid and can't afford a lawyer who need legal aid can take advantage of his guarantee. And he hasn't responded at all. And one of the things I've said is, you know, come down to my office. You'll see that we're not elites. Like, you'll see that there's a stereotype of we don't have public defenders in Ontario. We have a different system that I think works very well and actually saves the government a lot of money. But you'll see that the stereotype about, you know, the American public defender who, you know, his budgets are stretched thin, who works long hours, who, you know, doesn't have an office in a large tower with expensive art on the walls. And, you know, I'm not taking any of my clients to, you know, box seats at the Raptors game or anything like that. Like, come down and I'll show you how it is. Like, you know, it's always good to fight the elites, but I'll tell you what, if there's any elite here, it's you know, our politicians and not the people who they're seeking to cut funding from.
It's funny you mentioned the stereotypical vision of sort of the public defender, because I think people think about it the other way. Because on Law and Order, when you know, there's someone who's obviously, you know, just dripping with evil and guilt, and they usually have a high-priced lawyer who has all the dirty tricks, and I think that has sort of ingrained the popular consciousness of, you know, the evil defense attorney who's money grubbing and will defend anyone for infamy and cash. And I don't know, it just seems like we have competing visions of what the legal system looks like.
Yeah, it's only lawyers who defend police officers who get the funding to live that sort of lifestyle. Anyone defending, you know, those living on the margins and is really half social worker and half lawyer. I mean, the amount of times, I mean, this goes back to sort of removing, you know, counsel of choice and this modest funding for bail hearings. The amount of times I act as social worker is incredible. You know, getting your clients into treatment, knowing their addiction history, so that when they come to court, I'm there and I can say what's worked and what's not worked, and what's a good plan and what's not a good plan, and what their triggers are and why they may have done what they've done, so we can resolve things faster to look for solutions that actually have long-term impacts. I mean, I'm with my clients quite often from you know, the moment where they start experiencing addiction and mental health issues, right up to when they die. I mean, today I'm going to a funeral for a client of mine who passed away. And over the last year, I've lost, I don't know, probably in the double digits of clients who have passed away from, you know, addiction-related issues or mental health-related issues or you know, suicide. So, I mean,
that's extraordinary.
Yeah, this is the burden that we carry, this, but we choose to do it. And, I mean, the fact that we're social workers, sometimes we are the only connection between our clients and services that can not only help them, but, you know, if you want to think about it from a sterile dollars and cents value, if we can help get someone into treatment, if we can help get them into housing, that makes financial sense for everyone.
Right.
And it also increases community safety. It's also good for our client. And, you know, you're getting that for $250. I mean, it's a good investment. But I think the government knows. I think the government knows that we care about more than just billing. And so they're counting on us. And I'll let you in on a secret. We're probably going to do all this work for free anyway. Because, you know, it would be inhuman to see individuals with this sort of level of need and not do anything to help. So I think that that's probably what the government's counting on as well.
Taking into account the humanity of lawyers, I mean, we can probably make a couple of jokes about that. But just from the sounds of it, you know, this bail hearing thing is something I've sort of gotten hung up on, because from what you're talking about, you know, people with addiction issues, mental health issues, these are people who may not be able to help in their own defense initially if they are brought in high, if they are brought in coming down from a bender, that you may have to put time and effort into getting that history, getting, you know, their records, because they may not be able to help in their own defense. And now they might be going into a legal system where they will not have the help of somebody like you who can get that sorted out. And then it seems like it's just automatically off to jail for them.
Yeah. And I mean, like, the amount of documents and stuff, most individuals, you know, they get their call to counsel, mm-hmm. but, you know, they don't get to call to get their treatment records. They don't get to, you know, and a lot of people don't have family to help with sort of the logistics of making sure that someone, you know, even if they have committed an offense, who should be released because the offense isn't a serious one, mm-hmm. has all the tools to make sure that they put a plan together that, you know, limits the risk of any reoffense, ensures public safety, and, you know, make sure that they come back to court. We have all that information and historic knowledge on our client, and we throw in for free getting the client's key from their property and going to their house and making sure their pets are taken care of, or making sure that, you know, that their check is deposited in their bank account so that they can pay their rent while they are in custody or while they're on bail, so they don't lose their housing that they've worked for a long time to get. So there's a broad range of services, and I just don't think you can remove such a vital part of, you know, this criminal justice system at the initial stage. I mean, studies have shown that the main determinant about whether someone is found guilty or not guilty, and one of the main determinants about how long they spend in custody, is whether they get bail at an early opportunity. And so we're just setting up a further sort of dichotomy between the haves and the have-nots in our justice system. And I really worry that it's not only going to cost a lot, but I really worry that it's going to cost lives and it's going to decrease community safety. And when we're looking at, you know, budgetary constraints and things like that, this is a drop in the bucket.
Yeah, we sort of talk about what the worst case scenario or what some of the scenarios might be in terms of the cuts and maybe future cuts, but what are the remedies? I mean, is it going to just be like we have to wait 3.5 years and maybe convince a new government that more funding has to be made, and not just to the original levels, but that you know people like you need more help to make sure that we are getting that equal access to justice we want?
I think that ultimately, I don't think that there is going to be any change in the government policy here. There's been no indication that there's going to be any reconsideration. I'm not hopeful that a future government is really going to do much to help things out, because, I mean, let's face it, increasing legal aid funding isn't, you know, a vote-getting exercise, and that's what, you know, many political parties are interested in. So I think in the interim, what we're going to see is we're going to see a lot more applications called RoboFM applications, where a very complicated application can be brought to a trial judge, and they can basically they throw the charge out of court unless the government funds the case. So there can be ways to force the government to fund cases. So we're going to see actually more court time being taken up with that. So we're going to have a doubling of sort of the use of court time by unrepresented individuals. So, I mean, there are some ways that lawyers can push back for the very, very serious cases. But I think for these mid-level cases, for the cases that, you know, are property offenses or are not super violent, and are driven by, you know, some of those factors like addiction and mental health, I fear that those people are just going to be left behind. And I mean, one of the long-term problems here is that if the government decides that those people are being left behind and instead of funding legal aid, shovels more of that work towards duty counsel, we could have an overworked duty counsel who are doing work that they've never signed on for. And to some extent are not capable logistically of doing. And then we might have some legacy costs there. We could have more wrongful convictions there as well. And we could just have sort of a facade of justice. Justice isn't served just if it appears to happen, if you have a cardboard cutout there with you. And so I don't know what the solution is. I hope that the government, listens. Because on this one time, on this one issue, it seems that the public might actually be against legal aid cuts, which is something that we haven't seen. So perhaps if Ford isn't interested in, long-term economic prudence and isn't interested in justice, perhaps he is interested in his own thin political skin, and maybe we'll see something because of that.
Well, a facade of justice seems like a terrible place to leave the interview, but I think that's where we'll have to leave it.
Well, hopefully at some point we have something more positive to talk about. But, I mean, I do want to say that there are lots of people fighting this issue. Here in Ottawa, we have, some tremendous access to justice advocates. And we see, support from academia and even from some of those lawyers on Bay Street in their towers, doing what they can to help out as well. So, this is one issue where, I think, the more the public knows, the better. And thank you very much for helping get the public to where they need to be.
Michael Spratt, thank you so much for your time and your expertise today.
No problem. Anytime.
Anthea Milliken, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Adam.
Let's start with what happened on Friday with that announcement. Can you talk a bit about that and how that came about and why that's such a big piece that's missing from the work that the Legal Aid Clinic does now?
Yes. So a little bit of background about the clinic. The clinic has been operating in the community since 2002, and we are funded by Legal Aid Ontario, and we're governed by a community board of directors. And we provide services primarily in housing and income issues. So we give advice to all tenants, and we also help with Ontario Works, ODSP, CPP disability, but we also like to practice in a holistic way. So we often invite people to contact us with their what we call everyday legal issues, and then we try to sort through what's going on in people's lives. And what presents a lot in Guelph and Wellington County is family law. I mean, we have a huge demand for family law services. So prior to 2016, the only family law information clinic that operated in Guelph was the Friday morning clinic at the courthouse from 9 to 12. And so in 2016, a couple of things happened. There was a recognition that we needed additional services for victims of domestic violence. And there was also recognition that there was a need for additional advice services for family law that could come out of the clinic. So we set up, I'll talk about the clinic one and then I'll talk about the one at Women in Crisis. So we set up a Monday afternoon clinic that operates in conjunction with our legal clinic to deliver combined family and criminal law advice. And we are located, Adam, inside the Guelph Community Health Center. So this is a very busy place, and there are a lot of services that are provided through the center, and it's a real hub in terms of services for low-income people. So in addition to primary care, of course, there is the supervised consumption site. There's Hep C, street outreach with Sanguine, midwife services, all kinds of diabetes, all kinds of things happen here in the center. So this was a really good, we moved in here in I think, 2015. So in terms of what was happening in 2016, this was a really good place to also deliver family and criminal services, law services. I'll talk a little bit in a moment about why that was so important to us. But at the same time, there was a recognition of the need, and also through Legal Aid Ontario, a recognition of the need for enhanced services for victims, survivors of domestic violence.
Right.
And so what was set up was the duty counsel would go in the morning to women in crisis and work with the family court support worker to provide advice services there, which was an amazing partnership because really it sees or it saw the family court support worker doing a lot of the legwork, a lot of the paperwork, a lot of the time-consuming meeting with the women to find out what's going on,
right?
What are you looking for? And then duty counsel could come in and simply look at the paperwork, have that kind of, next steps conversation. So very, very efficient
right.
and a very low barrier way of getting services because it's right there in Women in Crisis Center, a place that people feel comfortable and somewhere that was a good place to get that service.
Right.
So what happened on Friday, so a little bit before I go back and talk about why this is such an impactful decision, is that what happened on Friday is that we received a fax indicating that effective immediately these two clinics were canceled and that people who need family law advice could access family law advice back at the courthouse on Fridays between 9 and 12. Or could call Legal Aid Ontario for 20 minutes of summary advice if you qualify financially. Both
right.
clinics are based on financial qualification. So we did not anticipate that cut. We didn't see it coming. We were obviously very surprised and concerned and upset. Certainly, obviously Legal Aid is facing a huge financial challenge and we appreciate that and understand that and, know that there are cutbacks and reallocation of services. But it seems to me that these two clinics were such a good use of public funds because they were so efficient.
Right.
So going back to the one that operated here out of the health center, right out of our space here in the clinic, is that, often our clients present with numerous issues.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a housing issue, you have an income issue, you may have received, a provincial offenses ticket, you might have a family law issue.
Mm-hmm.
So we could easily refer to duty counsel here. We could easily, say, well, come on Monday afternoon and, come at 12 because people start lining up early. So the clinic ran from 12:30 to 3.
Right.
And people would start lining up at 12 to take a number and to wait in the hallway to talk to Richard, who is the duty counsel. And so we'd say, come back and talk to Richard on Monday. And then they could come back and have a short conversation with him. And then maybe come back the following week and say, okay, I did that, Richard. What should I do next? So it was very seamless. It was very helpful. We serve Guelph and Wellington County.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll talk a little bit about the county and some of the things that we're doing there. But sometimes people can't make it in for a variety of health reasons or transportation issues. And we would be able to coordinate with Richard to, set up a particular time. Like, this is an urgent situation. Richard, could you maybe talk to the person on the phone for a little bit?
Mm-hmm.
And so, we were able to make those kinds of arrangements because it was a consistent service operated through our clinic, right? But it was a Legal Aid Ontario service. Very surprising. In fact, it came on the heels of, I was hoping that we could have looked at having some enhanced family law services in the county.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, we are operating a a van, an outreach van. I don't know if you saw that.
Yep.
We have special funding from the Law Foundation to operate a van that travels throughout Wellington County to 12 different municipalities. And we have two outreach workers on the van who will talk to people about, you know, what's going on, and, you know, here are the resources that you can access. And then sometimes we'll Skype in myself or the other lawyer or the paralegal or our other housing caseworker to give them some advice on the spot. So it's a really great project. And we had hoped to maybe, bring a family law lawyer out to the van for, you know, a couple of visits. And so obviously all of that opportunity disappeared when, in fact, we lost the clinic here.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a step back. We hear, because we're present in the community and because we're very present in the county through the outreach van, we hear the demand for family law services.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're left with is what we had pre-2016, which is the family law clinic that operates at the courthouse, the family courthouse, on Friday mornings from 9 to 12.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously that's a reduction of service, and it's, you know, that's very concerning when the demand and the need is so high. And, you know, family law is a very complicated area of law.
Right.
And it's very procedural. There are a number of steps involved. In our jurisdiction, we do not have a unified family court. It's very complicated.
Mm.
And it's not something that's, you know, easily navigated. And one of the really nice things about having a consistent, experienced duty counsel present was that he could say, okay, this is what you should do next, this is what you should do next, this is what you should do next, right?
Mm-hmm.
And people really appreciated that, because he would look at the papers, he would, you know, give some coaching and some advice, and people felt very reassured, because it's a very frightening and complicated journey.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of the impact on women in crisis, That's a whole nother consideration, because really, women survivors had access to a trusted source,
mm-hmm.
and are now being asked to, you know, go to the general duty counsel clinic, where, you know, everybody else goes, right?
Right.
That's not an optimal situation for survivors of domestic violence who
right.
have experienced a great deal of trauma. And to go with, you know, potentially the abuser could be there.
Right.
There's no saying who will line up, right?
Yeah.
For service. So, you know, there are concerns. I also don't think that the courthouse is the most welcoming environment in order to do this. You know, we know from experience that community-based services are more welcoming and more barrier-free. We have a very open clinic here. People walk in, people have a coffee, you know, people have a conversation with us. We have a very, very welcoming environment where you can come and talk to us about what's going on in your life, and we'll try to sort out, you know, where can you get some help, right? It's quite a bit different environment in the courthouse. So obviously, it wasn't working before 2016, and that's why these clinics
right.
were put in place. So we're going backwards, really, in terms of the service that's available, and that's an unfortunate thing, because whenever you eliminate upstream interventions, you raise the possibility of more crisis in the community. You raise the possibility of more expensive interventions down the road, such as impacts on the healthcare system, impacts on policing, impacts on the justice system
right.
generally. So in our view, this is a very unfortunate thing. My hope, so Adam, you know, this is a period of great change in legal aid and how the service is being delivered. And the clinic system is being studied in terms of, you know, what kind of changes it can make going forward. And it's my sincere hope that we look at more of an integration of services, so so that people can access family law services through the clinic or in conjunction with clinic services, and that also that shelters would have embedded access to family law services. So really a complete revisioning of how family law services are delivered.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think that that's so critical in terms of the wellness of the community and in terms of keeping families
right
up with upstream intervention safer, frankly.
Right, because another part of this podcast, I was talking to a criminal lawyer, and he was talking about how he has to, when he's dealing with legal aid cases, he has to be part social worker, be part lawyer, be part, friend. And it seemed like, from the way he talked about his experience, a program like this is an interesting solution because people who are domestic abuse survivors have probably engaged women in crisis, are probably familiar with the staff there. And perhaps have just now worked up the courage to take the next step by going to court, but they already have that pre-existing relationship. That legwork has already been done.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, things don't happen, in isolation, right? Exactly what you say is that, there needs to be trust, and that people don't feel strong enough to take the next step. They need to have other things built around them. So, we work very much in conjunction with the transition team at Women in Crisis. We work with the social workers at the Guelph Community Health Center. We work with CMHA in the community. People need a circle of care around them in order to take the next step. And because it's exceptionally confusing, it's exceptionally stressful, as I indicated and as you could appreciate, there isn't usually one thing going on in people's lives. There are multiple things going on in people's lives. Being low income will also impact on your health.
Mm.
It will also impact on your mental well-being.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a matter of delivering traditional legal services. This work is quite different. We walk together with our clients. We try to be very practical. We try to say, well, maybe a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and, that'll get you through to next month.
Mm.
It's quite different work than traditional, someone saying, oh, I have this legal issue, I'm going to go see a lawyer and get some advice and then, act on that advice. I mean, things have to be done in a way that it's supported, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, we might be working with someone's support worker and, they may be able to accompany someone. There's a lot of elements to it. And one of the things that we're very good in Guelph with is working in partnership.
Mm.
So we rely very much on each other's resources. We rely on the drop-in. We rely on the Hope House. We rely on Chalmers. We rely very heavily on the SOS team.
Mm-hmm.
We rely on the outreach workers at the health center in the county. We rely on the outreach workers through the family health team. I mean, it's not possible to do this work in isolation.
Mm-hmm.
So these partnerships that have been established are so important. And, I've heard from, people that we work with who say, this is very upsetting, this is devastating, and certainly confirm that, this was a very well-used and successful program that took very little resources.
Mm-hmm.
It's my view that these services should be taken out of the courthouses
mm-hmm.
and put in the community, and that we have to move away from this model where people have to line up at the courthouse and rather have it in community.
Right. I know that this cut in particular you weren't expecting, but mm-hmm. have you, in terms of realizing it's a new government with a new focus, were you preparing for cuts?
Well, we've known about our own cut for mm-hmm. a little while now.
Mm-hmm.
So we lost 10% of our other operating budget. which obviously, you know, any cut is, you know, you have to figure out how to manage that cut.
Mm-hmm.
And so the board and staff have been thinking about how to manage that cut. Should we have foreseen the cut to family law services? You know, absolutely, we knew that there were cuts in service.
Mm-hmm.
I think, again, I will have to say that this one took us by surprise, because this was such an efficient way of having a huge impact. So, you know, our focus is very much, what is the impact on the client? Does this make this harder for clients to access services? Absolutely. Does it make it harder for clients to navigate complex systems? Absolutely. You know, so we appreciate that Legal Aid has a huge, you know, job in trying to manage these cuts and in trying to, you know, reduce the impact on client service.
Mm-hmm.
This one took us by surprise. And we're hoping that we can, you know, revisit this issue, look at other ways of delivering these services, take them out of the courthouse, for instance, and basically get them in community where people know that they can get help.
Mm.
People know they can get help here at our clinic. People are very comfortable coming here. People are very comfortable walking in and just, you know, saying hello and then having a conversation where we find out, oh, yes, you do have this, you know, issue that needs attention. You have several issues that need attention. And let's help you figure that out, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's the model that works very well. And we're certainly hoping that down the road that there'll be some changes so that, you know, that model will continue, because we know from experience that this is how people best get help, right?
Right.
It's just small amounts of timely help by people that you trust.
Mm. Mm-hmm. So, you know, advocacy is part of your job. So how are you moving forward? Like, is there a path forward in terms of, like, advocating for more support, or at least maybe stopping future cuts? Because one of the things that's in the ether is that, you know, this isn't the end of the cuts. There could be more coming.
I think that absolutely, you know, we need to continue to talk about what our clients' experience is, and, you know, continue to look for that client-focused approach. Personally, I'm very interested in how can we, if we're going to change the system, how can we build a system that's based on a client-centered approach? So, you know, I'm going to, you know, I need to look for a bit of optimism in this.
Right.
And so I need to feel that there is, as you say, a path forward. And for me, the path forward is very much to talk about innovative services, to talk about client-centered services, to talk about how we can work with our partners to look at, you know, having people access a broad range of services. We were involved and we were invited to the discussions on the formation of the Ontario Health Team in the county.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that we're very interested in. We're very interested in the intersection of health and legal well-being. We were an early adopter of the legal health checkup. We run a secondary consultation project or program now where agencies can call us directly and say, you know, I've got this client who has this issue, you know, what can you suggest? Which sounds really simple, but in the world of delivering legal services, it's pretty radical to not speak directly to the client.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's something that we've embraced. It came out of Halton. We were an early adopter of it, of that program. And so, you know, again, looking at ways to break down barriers, looking at ways of getting help to people who need it through the people that they trust and rely upon. So if I get a CMHA worker who calls me and says, I have a client who, this is what's happening, then I can say, okay, well, here are my best suggestions. And you know, I don't worry so much about whether or not that will be relayed to the client accurately. I mean, I shouldn't say that as a lawyer because I know it's that's important.
Right.
But what I'm saying is it's important to me that someone who's helping that person, a trusted intermediary, mm-hmm. has some information about what the next step could be. Because to me, it's more likely that the client who is overwhelmed and who is experiencing a tremendous amount of hardship hears it from someone who's right there with them, who's walking that path with them and says, okay, so I think we should, you know, I talked to the legal clinic and I think this is what we should do next. To me, that's helpful. And really, it's all about helping clients make it through this incredibly complicated labyrinth of administrative and court law mm-hmm. that is overwhelming.
Right. I'm not sure what to say other than good luck.
Well, thank you, Adam. Thank you. And, you know, I think that, again, this community, Guelph and Wellington County, works very well together.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I encourage our funder and I encourage everyone to really look at the things that we do in this community and the partnerships that we have and continue to support that because, you know, that's what makes Guelph Wellington so recognized in terms of the work that we do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a good place to end it on. I'm just going to sign off the podcast. So, Anthea Milliken, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Adam. My pleasure.
And once again, that was Michael Spratt and Anthea Milliken. And you can read more of Spratt's writings about the law and politics on his blog at michaelspratt.com. And you can listen to his podcast, The Docket, by downloading it from SoundCloud or subscribe to it on iTunes. To access the services of the Legal Clinic of Guelph and Wellington County, you can find them online at gwlegalclinic.ca. Call them at 519-821-2100 or visit their offices at 176 Wyndham Street North. And that's it for this edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics, Ed Sid Dale. You can download the Guelph Politicast every Wednesday from iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify, or you can download it from our host, Podbean, at guelphpoliticast.podbean.com. And when you subscribe to the Guelph Politicast, you will also get an episode of Open Sources Guelph on Mondays and an episode of End Credits on Fridays. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com, reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson or at Guelph Politico. You can also check out Guelph Politico on Facebook at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And if you'd like to help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph, then please consider donating to Guelph Politico, and you can find out how at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. And for all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.ca, where there will be a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you in the very near future. And until then, see you next time.